No, I'm just kidding.
So cancer is something that you have to have faith in. Now, you know you might have cancer, though. If you have cancer, you know you have that. In Abraham's case, he didn't have any children. And they were so old that trying to comprehend how you're going to have those kids or descendants. Well, don't forget that. Just don't forget that.
What was accounted to him as righteousness? What specifically?
What was counted to him as righteousness? Well, you've got to agree to the verse. It was his faith.
His faith in what?
That's what I was asking earlier.
What
is it?
What God promised.
Is it the promise or is it his faith in God?
It would go to believing who God is, what God does, and what God says. All aspects of him, who he is, that are righteous.
Mm-hmm.
Were you going to look at 17:17? I don't know if you were planning to or not, but that's where Abraham laughed.
Yes. Well, that's... I wasn't going to go there, no. Not today, because that's not the list on my
list.
Well,
see, I didn't know if we were allowed to talk about it, because I thought, you know, it says he believed, and it was credited him as righteousness, but then later he laughed about it. So did he really believe? Did he believe for a moment? Is that how we are supposed to? So was it credited to him because of his belief in the promise? Later he didn't really.
Well, his laugh takes place a little later. We'll get to that one in another minute, but not at this section. But you have to think about it. I mean, okay, put yourself in Abram's shoes. God comes and says, you're going to have as many descendants as far as the stars, and you can't even count them.
Right.
Now, Abram may have believed in God, but I think I would have chuckled and laughed myself. Does laughing about the situation that we're going to read here in Genesis 17:17, and Sarah, when she laughs, does that mean they didn't believe?
No.
Or...
That could have been a little bit.
I think you need to read the context before you answer that question.
Yeah.
Right.
Because, by the way, I don't know what your lesson book says, but I disagree with what my lesson book says.
You disagree with it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Page 43 there. Where the two descriptive terms that.
Yeah, I'll read it.
Joy and amazement.
Yes, mine says that too. It says this, that later on Abraham laughed with joy and amazement at the thought that God was going to do this great thing. I don't know that that's exactly what Abraham was.
That's not how I would interpret.
Not from the scripture. No.
So, anyhow.
I wasn't going to really hone in on that just because I didn't.
Well,
it's not in the Bible.
The reason I'm sort of honing in on it is because I see this whole thing of what was credited to him as righteousness. If our righteousness is dependent on believing all of God's promises and having this faith as if without doubt, we're in trouble. Because even Abraham struggled to believe what God said he was going to do that he was willing to do. I don't see Abraham having a blind faith. But I see Abraham, even though in his mind he could not actually believe that it was going to happen, he had a faith in God that he, even logically, it didn't make sense but he was choosing to believe in God because God said it. And to me, that's such a significant thing, because that's where I find myself quite often. Is, really? Okay? So, really?
Mm-hmm.
But, okay, God, you said it, so I'm going to believe it.
Mm-hmm. You would be saying that your illustration there is that choosing to trust the sovereignty of God versus my intellectual thought, or what we know as
sure, as
seeing that.
Sure. And that's why I, you know, I just wanted to just come back to that thing of what does it mean when it says he was credited to him as righteousness? What was credited to him? It was not the simple fact of this illogical belief that everything is going to, you know, name it and claim it type of thing, that everything's going to work out. But rather, it was a resolute faith in the character of God. And that's where the righteousness came into play, the credit of righteousness. Because there's all kinds of, I don't want to say people, but teaching approaches to Christianity where it says, well, you just got to have enough faith.
Mm-hmm. Just believe it and claim it.
And this whole thing of, well, you got to have enough faith to be saved. Well, no. Believing deep down in the character of God, even though my own mind, I can't wrap my brain around it.
Mm-hmm.
And,
well, why was it, taking that thought, not being able to, why was it that it was credited to him? This thing of being
at the term credit?
Yeah. Why did God say it was credited to him? I mean, we've got this up here. It was, you know, Abraham believed God. His statement of an account. He was a descendant of Adam, which makes him a... You and I are descendants of Adam,
sinners.
Or we're sinners, right?
Sinners, right.
So his account, in essence, to satisfy his account, would have caused him to have total death. I mean, that's the three deaths. Physical.
Spiritual.
And
eternal,
right. God says I've accredited. In other words, I've got this credit on your account. It's because he believes. There's a reason why it's a credit right now. Why is it a credit?
I mean, through all that he went through as far as struggling to really think it could happen, what he said to Adam.
Okay. There's another reason why I'm asking.
Jesus hasn't came.
Ah, yeah, the deliverer hasn't come through yet. So it's like he's storing up this for Abram, this credit in a bank. He's got this stored up because the deliverer hasn't come yet. And I don't know if that goes down the same line what you were talking about, Lynn. But
that's great. It's fine. Yeah.
Let's read 15:12-16.
As the sun was setting, Abram fell into a deep sleep, and a thick and dreadful darkness came over him. Then the Lord said to him, "Know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and that they will be enslaved and mistreated there. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your ancestors in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure."
Okay, before that passage that we read, we skipped over there. You have this conversation going back and forth between God, and Abram is there. He is essence, what Lynn was saying. In his heart, he really questioned, how do I really know this is going to come about? And God tells him to go grab some animals and offer sacrifice, and then he was made a covenant with him. He split them down, and he would pass through the center of these animals. And then he goes and Abram now goes and falls into a deep sleep, and God began to speak to him in a vision, dream, and tells him this horrific tale about his descendants, that they're going to be in slavery for 400 years. And this may be where we go back and find out where some people say a generation is 100 years, because it says four generations and it's 400 years. So depending on your terminology of a generation, you know, that type of thing there. But what does this tell you about God? In this dream, what are you learning about God again?
What does it mean by a thick and dreadful darkness?
I'd rather not find out.
And then the Lord speaks to him. I mean, it sounds counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm. You got to imagine, might be going through his mind when he finds out that they're going to be captives and they're going to be strangers in a foreign land. They're going to be oppressed to slavery. I mean, God may have been showing him all the different things that they were going to go through, you know, and that could be pretty horrific stuff. It is very dark. I don't know. I mean, I wasn't there, but I mean,
right.
ever have a nightmare or something where you wake up and you're in a cold sweat because you've had something that has just come over you, you know? And usually, oftentimes, that can be related back to an incident in life or something you saw, or, you know, because dreams have they come from the business or happenings of life, a lot of times the Bible says. So you have.
He tells about his mortality. He'll live to a good old age, and then you'll go to your ancestors.
That's what he says here. So he reassured him, but what does it tell us about God in this dream?
Through all that's going to happen, he's still going to take care of
them. He's going to take care of them, and they're going to return to the land. Mm-hmm. It also tells us that God is all-knowing.
Yes.
That God is over all. That this, it reinforces the sovereignty of God, that he is over everything, and he can see into the future. And he knows what's going to take place. So he's going through this whole thing, and we're going to skip over chapter 16. Chapter 16 is where now the human side comes into play, which, I don't know, did you ever cover that in your class, Lynn? Before, where the humanness of mankind trying to make the will of God happen. Skips over that and goes to this passage in chapter 17. But chapter 16 is where Sarah comes and says, "Hey, I've got a servant over here. You take her for a wife and have a child through her." So that's how God's going to bring about this thing. That's not what God said, right? He didn't say anything about that. So here's mankind trying to figure out this thing. That's the way I see that chapter. I mean, it's kind of like when you have a decision to make and you cry out to God, and then you might not have an answer right away, so you try to figure something out and make it work. I don't know. But
that's
I'm seeing.
Exactly. I think that ties very closely to what we were saying about Abraham doubting and laughing. You know, we can't get in our minds that Abraham's righteousness was tied to his blind belief or blind faith in what God had promised.
Right.
It had to be much deeper than just that surface promise. It was something that he believed in who God was, not just the promise. And it led him down the road to make mistakes. And you could, the very same thing you could take with Lot, going, it's the same thing.
And today in our world, we're suffering because Abraham and Sarah tried to be God.
Yeah, I see what you're getting.
In essence. In other words, what was not God's intent or plan, as we'll find out here in a little bit, our world suffers today because of that. And it's a pretty painful suffering.
If they didn't do that, would we still suffer?
I don't know. And when I say we suffer, the world around us, Hagar was Sarah's slave, servant, whatever, handmaiden, someone who helped her out around her place. And she gave to Abram for a wife. They have a son, Ishmael. Ishmael is where you get
the other
Palestine, the Muslim Arab world today.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this conflict going around over there, all because Abram and Sarah said, well, we'll make this happen this way, instead of totally trusting in what God said. So,
wouldn't the result of what Eve and Adam did Lucifer be more of why we suffer?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's not because they were perfect and they chose to go down this, but again, you see mankind, just like in the Garden of Eden, mankind trying to
do his will.
Yes.
So,
trying
okay,
to.
So you're saying it's more of a repeating.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, a repeating thing.
Still do
okay.
it today.
Yep, we still do it today.
Just
yep, absolutely. That's a good word, Lori. We do still do it today. Well, let's read what happens in Genesis 17, then. So, 1 through 5.
And when Abram was 90 years old and nine, the Lord appeared to Abram and said unto him, I am the Almighty God, walk before me and be thou great. And I will make my covenant between me and thee, and will multiply thee exceedingly. And Abram fell on his face, and God talked to him, saying, As for me, behold, my covenant is with thee, and thou shalt be a father of many nations. Neither shall thy name any more be called Abram, but thy name shall be Abraham, for father of many nations have I made thee.
Okay, so you again have God appearing to him. Now this takes place 13 years after Ishmael, his son through Hagar, is born, because he's now 99. Ishmael was born when he was 86. So it's 13 years later, God appears to him again, comes and talks with him, and changes his name. Now why did God change his name from Abram to Abraham?
Someone new, you know, through what he had been through,
mm-hmm.
as far as the righteousness, the not really believing that, you know, could God really do this, but then having that core belief and seeing that through was molded into somebody more new.
That could be, but I think there's something else there. It's found in the verses of what he said, why he changed his name to Abraham. It's kind of right after it.
Because it says he has made him a father of many nations.
Okay, yeah, so it can be tied into that he's new, something new, but it's also tied into this thing of that your descendants will become many nations. So now think about that. Many nations. You have the children of Israel. That come out of Abram. You have all the Arab nations that we have today are out of, because of Ishmael. Where else would there be nations?
In the world or in this time?
Well, I don't know. It could have been this time. It could be even today. There's lots of nations today, that come. And Abraham, it says that he is the father of many nations. It just doesn't mean one nation or two nations. It could be multiple. Lots and lots of nations come through Abraham's descendants. God didn't stop there, though. Let's read 17, skip down to verse 15 and 16.
God said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you are no longer to call her Sarai. Her name will be Sarah. I will bless her and will surely give you a son by her. I will bless her so that she will be the mother of nations. Kings and people will come from her.
Again, the same principle, the same reason God changed her name, because she's going to be the mother of many nations. It's very interesting that if you think about names, God puts a great deal of emphasis on names. You go back to Adam and Eve in the garden when he named them, and then you got here God naming, renaming Abraham, Abram to Abraham and Sarai to Sarah. And so it's a very very interesting thing. I don't know how you feel about it in your own family, but I look at my kids and I say, okay, I gave them certain names, right? Well, I still get grief for naming Catherine. Because as a kid growing up, I watched all kinds of old westerns at my grandmother's house. And John Wayne westerns was my grandma's thing. And almost every wife or woman that he had relationship with, name was Catherine. So they always, you named it because of that. And Catherine's in the movies were all redheaded, firehead, fire, spitfire women. Okay, and so as a kid, I always thought, oh, as my kids grew up, I thought, man, is Catherine going to be one of these spitfire women because of the name? So there are some things in here, but you have this thing about God and names. And he puts a very strong emphasis on that, and I just thought I'd throw that in there. That wasn't in the lesson book, but now let's see what happens. You got this conversation going on between Abraham and God. And verse 17 says this. Now, and then Abraham, he bowed himself down to the ground, but he laughed inside himself in disbelief. And this is what he said inside his heart. How could I become a father at the age of 100? And this is what he thought. And how can Sarah have a baby when she is 90 years old? That's normal. Kevin said that's normal.
Not to have a baby at that age.
Oh, okay. Not to have a baby at that age. Right. So to answer the question, why was it possible for God to make this happen? Because he can do anything, right? He's all powerful. He's all sovereign. He knows everything. And there's nothing that's impossible with him. So I think this ties into very well with what Lynn was saying earlier about that, yes, Abraham believed God, but inside he wasn't necessarily believing.
And how many years before this did God give him that thought?
That's a good question. I don't know how many years. Maybe we could trace it back. I didn't read that, but I do know it's more than 13.
Yeah, right. I mean, just think about it. If somebody promised you something, and 13 years later you still didn't have it, would you really think it could happen?
Yep.
Well, I think in verse 18, I think he's more worried about Ishmael, what he has, than what he's going to have, too.
Mm. Yeah, he talks about, he asked God a question there about his son Ishmael.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Be blessed.
I wonder, yeah, it's always been an interesting thought to me, is that Abraham obviously grew to love or loved Ishmael.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so he was wanting Ishmael to receive God's blessing, even though he was not the son of promise. And well, you could go all kind of directions with that when you think about long-term ramifications of that unbelief.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I just don't think we quite realize at times, maybe I don't quite realize at times, how much a simple faith in what God has said, even though it doesn't make sense, is extremely important. And it has life ramifications. Maybe not just for you, but maybe for years down the road.
That's a very good thought. That if we're not careful and with our faith in God and who He is and His character, that it could affect future generations and future nations, actually. Interesting. Any other thoughts before we move on? Because we're going to stop here and we're going to go to Sodom and Gomorrah next.
Just to touch on the Ishmael, I mean, God did bless him and said he was going to be the father of 12 kings, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And he will make him a great nation. So that was already preambled by God.
Yeah, so if you finish reading this out, Abraham asked God this.
But his covenant is still with Isaac.
And that's what Abraham was asking him. Can you tie him in underneath this special covenant that you made with me?
Right.
That was a special covenant, pact. You know, the word covenant is what is used. But it was a connecting, you know, promise that God had made. I'm using the word promise, but I don't really think the word promise does justice to what a covenant is.
Covenant's like a binding.
It is, yes. It's a covenant's much deeper than an actual promise. And maybe I'm splitting hairs there, but there's something much deeper in a covenant than just a simple promise. And That's what Abraham was asking. Hey, can we get Ishmael underneath this same thing? And God says, no, that is not going to be the way. I'll still bless him,
right,
but it's not going to be this special covenant.
Right.
And we've got to remember that, because later on, is when we get to the deliverer part, the covenant that God uses here in the Old Testament, and we get a new covenant in the New Testament, there is a special connection with that covenant, and we're not nowhere near getting to that. But covenant is, there's something unique and very special about a covenant that God made with Abraham here. I don't know, Lynn, if that's down the lines where you had in your classes before, but that's, to me, when we talk about marriage today is a covenant. And so when you have a special binding together of a covenant, we had Adam and Eve, he said, the two of you shall become one flesh, and you'll be known as husband, you know, man and wife. That's a covenant. And that is a covenant relationship there. And so it's a very, very, it's very special to God, a covenant is. Let's go to Sodom and Gomorrah. And I'm going to skip over here to this. Okay, so here we are. Here's the map, Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, Vince pointed out last week about this theory that he had. Anybody remember the theory?
The Dead Sea.
The Dead Sea. Okay. Well, yeah, notice where that dot is on the map. So, it's a theory. Can't prove it. It's not in the scriptures, but let's see what happens here. All right, Genesis 18, 20 through 21.
Then the Lord said, the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is immense, and their sin is extremely serious. I will go down to see if what they have done justifies the cry that has come up to me. If not, I will find out.
What did God know about every person in Sodom and Gomorrah? Everything. He knew they did everything. What they did, what was going on, what they said, what they thought. And God used some specific language here that it says that he heard the outcry, right? Now, how you read that?
Where was the outcry coming from?
Exactly. That was a question that I had. So I was hoping somebody else could answer that one for me.
Isn't it like the same as Cain and Abel?
Ah.
The outcry of their sins in the blood.
Ah, could be.
It was the same thing that it cried out to God.
Mm-hmm.
That is the same.
So it couldn't possible like Firefly this past week where it was really loud and the cry of the town was just the wildness that was going on there in the town that God was in. It could be something down along that lines. I don't know. But it could be very much what, like, when in God was referring to Cain and Abel, the ground, you hear his blood crying out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or an angel tattling or something.
It could be because the passage before, the little bit before that, you have these three men, angels of God, the angel of the Lord, meeting with Abraham, and they leave and go to Sodom, and they could be calling back. It could be that.
Mm-hmm.
But we have this. We have this cry out, and God hears it, and God knows everything that's going on. He hears everything. He sees their thoughts. He knows their heart, and he knows what they speak and say. And so God holds every man and woman, child, or every human being accountable. We've learned that through what God said, you're going to die if you eat of this tree. We know that God, when he says something, we saw it in the flood. And here is God again. He says this. So, and you think again back to the flood. And so that God is here. And so God is ready again to judge Sodom and Gomorrah. The wickedness had got so great that it displeased him. However, God doesn't punish right away, right? What did we learn about God's grace and his mercy and through the flood? It was very long-suffering, right? He was very gracious for many, many years. We estimated 100 to 120 years, right? And so God is very, very loving and patient, and wanting people to repent. And so here we have Lot. He's living in Sodom. So skip right over, jump way on over to Genesis 19, verse 1 through 3, and it says this. That evening, two angels came to the entrance of the city of Sodom. Lot was sitting there. Remember what I said, that Lot had his tent on the outskirts in the plains earlier, and now he is sitting in the city gate. He's sitting there meeting them. And when he saw them, he stood up to meet them. He welcomed them and bowed his face to the ground. And he said, my lords, come to my home and wash your feet and be my guests for the night. You may then get up early in the morning and be on your way again. Oh no, they replied. We'll just spend the night out here in the city square. Mm-hmm. Now, did these men look like angels to him? It says they're angels. But he obviously thought they were travelers or something maybe a little different. Maybe he recognized them as angels. Maybe he knew they were men of greatness because he wanted them to come to their house and
right.
He wanted
he
to host them.
My lord, so
right.
That's a man of a higher stature.
Uh-huh. Yep. Yeah. And they decided to stay in the city square. They were going to sleep there for the night, right? Sure, let's go to one of the roughest cities in the United States, which I don't know.
Chicago
right now. And you're coming there with a warning, and you're coming there to destroy a city. God's giving you this command. God sends his angels. And no, we'll sleep in the city square. Lot obviously knew what was going on in that city, right? What does he do? Let's see what happens. I'm behind on my thing here. So God, or Lot knows. So what does he say? He says, Lot insisted. So they at last went home with him. Lot prepared a feast for them, complete with fresh bread made through without yeast, and they ate. But before they retired for the night, all the men of Sodom, young and old, came from all over the city and surrounded the house. They shouted to Lot, "Where are the men you came to spend the night with you? Bring them out so we can," and my Bible says, "have sex with them." So Lot says, stepped outside to talk with them, shutting the doors behind them. "Please, my brothers." Well, that's, I don't know how some of your translations, but he says, "Please, my brothers." Does other ones use that?
Friends.
Friends, okay. So he used the word friends. He begged, "Don't do such wicked thing. Look, I have two virgin daughters. Let me bring them out to you. You can do with them what as you wish. But please leave these men alone, for they are my guests and under my protection." They yelled at him, "Stand back. This fellow came to town as an outsider, and now he's acting like our judge. We will treat you far worse than those other men." And they lunged toward Lot to break down the door. That's some pretty crazy stuff.
Right.
Anybody ever anything like that happen at your house? Yeah, visitors come to your house and all the neighbors.
That's a bad question.
I'm just asking.
I don't know, but I think the last thing I would say is here's your daughters.
I mean, what in the world? I got four daughters and there ain't no way that I'm going to do that.
Right.
There is absolutely no way in my mind would I offer one of them to protect somebody else.
But that gives me the idea that Lot knew who these men were. Doesn't it? You?
How?
Could be. I don't know, but it just gives me that idea that Lot knew that these men were just ordinary drivers.
It's something to do with guests, too.
But if he would have known who they were, he would have... Why would he not have trusted in their power and their ability to protect him? And I hear what you're saying, but I'm not sure. This, by the way, is probably in my opinion, one of the most grotesque stories in the Bible.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Why was that wrong for the men to go charging after these other two men?
Phrase that again.
Why was it wrong for those men to want to have sex with those two men?
Oh.
Huh?
Just to hurt one
reason.
Why is that a question?
Yeah.
Because in that time, in that day and age, it was something that they did. So I'm asking, why was it wrong?
It was against the design God had.
Very good, Kevin. It's not what God designed man and woman, men for. You don't have sex with men and women with women. God designed that between a husband and a wife. And it was something that God created. And here was a city, an entire city. It says the entire city. Men and women. I believe it, if I remember right reading this, it says young and old.
Right.
Yes, it says young and old. All the men of the city. Like Glenn said, sick men. But it goes against what God had set up from the beginning of time. The people of Sodom and Gomorrah, that makes it gives a picture of them being very arrogant. They don't care. The Bible says they were proud, and they did these detestable things before God. Someone grab Ezekiel 16:49-50. how many of you would agree that this city was wicked?
Yeah.
They were, this is, I mean, let's see what Ezekiel 16, 49 through 50 says.
Now this was the sin of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters were arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and needy. They were haughty and did detestable things before me. Therefore I did away with them, as you have seen.
My version says, so I removed them when I saw them.
Mm-hmm. All disobedience to God is sin. Not just the specific sin of homosexuality. And that's the word that we use in our culture today. It's actually sodomy. That seems a little bit more harsh when you use that word. Use the word homosexual today in our world, it doesn't sound as graphic as Sodom. And so you can see as our culture has changed things to make it not sound so bad.
Or just acronyms.
Acronyms today.
That's right.
Now, doesn't make that sin any worse than any other, because all sin in the eyes of God is disobedience. And ultimately, demands the penalty of.
I get what you mean by all sins equal as a disobedience, but when Deuteronomy, I think it is in the laws, God laying out the sins and followed by the punishments, it seems to define them as different levels as far as what God deems as either against nature, against yourself, others.
Okay, I see where you're coming from with that.
I guess my argument would be, is each sin actually equal in the sense that the punishment the way God sees it, not just as a generic act of disobedience?
Yes and no. And what I mean by that is, sin is, we have learned that sin is punishable by one punishment. Ultimate punishment is death. Sin separates us from God. So, I have never been homosexual, but I have lied, I have stolen time, things, you know, as a kid.
Right.
You know, you think about things like that. When you do things, that separates me from God. And so, the ultimate punishment, without having the deliverer, I die. So I agree with you that God lays out in the law, there were certain things that God said, you will die if you do this. And other things you had to repay, maybe a fine or something of that nature, where it is to cover for that payment. So I can see that where your question is with that. But ultimately, when we all die, if there is no payment for the sin that we've committed, we still die the three deaths. It's total separation from God.
Right.
Lynn, have you ever had that question before in class like
sure.
that? How?
Sure. Yeah, and I would just say, I think your short way to say it would be that all sin separates us from God. So in that sense, all sin is disobedience from God. So we cannot say, well, I haven't done this, so therefore, God should accept me because I'm not as bad as this person.
Yeah.
Not like a Dante's Inferno type of different levels of sin.
Yeah. No, we're just saying, in the eyes of God, sin is sin. However, there is also, you're right, that God did in the Old Testament set different levels of sin. And if you look at that, even today, our sins have different levels of consequences, different levels of impact. And that's what, you know, the sin of, well, take sexual sins, for instance, their impact is much more greater than gluttony or greed or something like that. You know, it just, so there's different levels, but in the eyes of God, they're all sin.
Mm-hmm.
That, so what are you thinking, Michael? Or Nathan?
Well, sorry. I think it was on the same page, I guess. It is all the same. I mean, Adam started with the sin of more or less disobedience. But I guess eventually when the outcry, as it's called, gets so high to God, I mean, this was one that God had to come down for. He doesn't mention, well, he did for Noah, kind of re-examine the world. But there's not a lot of times where God comes and he re-examines and says, this is getting wiped out because of this, say, something of a, what we would consider a lesser degree, stealing. But at different levels, God commands certain acts that we should then perform, not that we're doing that anymore. But I mean, even today, like you said, our own system is loosely based on the concept that we have different degrees, which require different levels of punishment. I guess that's what I was kind of.
What's the value in knowing that? How does that help us?
Not much, but I like to know it.
To be civilized, I guess.
This took place before.
What's the danger in knowing that?
Thinking you're better than somebody else.
If we don't value the direct thing line, then if our hearts are actually correct towards God and we are in line with Christ, we can judge one another because, like a Pharisee, we can believe that because we are doing these acts that we're better off than the person who has nothing.
So I'm not at all disagreeing. I'm really glad you brought this up because this is good. It's good stuff. I think Jesus struggled with communicating, getting this through the thick head of the religious people of their day, that they were sinners, that they couldn't do everything right. Jesus struggled with it. And God, through the ages. And that's why I think the lesson just keeps hammering over and over again that all sin is disobedience to God. Because the reality is, no matter what you or anybody else has done in their past, I am as equally guilty as they are, and I need to look at other people that way.
Mm-hmm.
I've taught this class, and we've been on this topic, and I can see in the eyes of people, I'm not seeing here tonight, I'm just saying I've seen it in the eyes of people, a glaze that comes over when they begin to think of their past offenses against them, and they say, how can that sin, what that person did to me, was much greater than anything else I have ever done to anybody else. And you can see it in their eyes, that there's like a hardness that develops there. And I would just respond to it this way, that I'm going to murder this fly. I would just respond to it this way, that sin has different levels of consequences. Sin has different levels of pain that it inflicts on people.
Mm-hmm.
And I am, by saying that all sin is equal and that is all disobedience to God, I'm not minimizing that pain.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not minimizing the different levels of consequences. And you can forgive someone for what they have done against you, but that does not mean that the trust is rebuilt or restored.
Mm-hmm.
With forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And see, you're hitting on it. You're opening this can of worms that goes deep down in and affects all of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Because sin has impacts on people.
Mm-hmm.
And but the simple, if we can take the simple approach that, okay, so this person has done all these things. On one level, he's a lot worse person than I am. But on another level, I'm just as guilty as he is. So I'm not sure how you all wrestle that out in your own lives, in our own minds. But it's a significant struggle.
Kind of look at it too as God's guidelines of how we should love people.
Mm-hmm.
And when I think about it, that's what Jesus did.
Mm-hmm.
No matter whether if you were a tax collector and stole people's money, you were a prostitute and sold your body for sex, God didn't look at you any other way but with love. And to me, that's guidelines. That's setting an example of that,
yeah.
Along with everything.
And that's very good. That's what I'm saying. It's you're putting good words there to say that when we see all sin as equal, it enables us to love someone despite what they have done.
Mm-hmm.
But do not cross that love. Don't take that word love as saying we can and parallel it to trust.
Hmm.
No,
there's difference.
Yeah, that's a huge difference between that.
Right, kid, I'm not. I'd like to be right.
Why?
You know, I'm gonna piggyback on this. You mind?
No, go for it.
How many of you would view Lot? How many of you would view Lot through the same eyes that you would view Abraham right now? After what Lot just did? Would you put him on the same level as Abraham? As far as his righteousness?
No.
I think our human selves would look at that and say, well, no. You were more against God than he did. God wouldn't want us to love him any different.
Okay,
yeah.
I understand. But
I'm sitting here thinking, humanly speaking,
right, because
hearing
Abraham
his story,
did stuff too. I mean,
yeah,
so
Abraham lied, and
so
they
was
both
Lot.
Had
their,
Lot
they both had their differences.
In looking at what Lot just did, is
Abraham
Lot a righteous guy?
Done what he thought was right. Okay.
Is that what made him righteous?
Mm-hmm. Did he go back?
Was he a righteous
God?
Guy?
Further in, does it talk about how he still went back to God and had faith and believe? Does it talk about that? Because here it just says what he did.
I haven't read.
That's what would determine the righteousness.
But humanly,
someone grab 2 Peter 7.
Mm-hmm.
2 Peter 2, 7 and 8.
And while you're doing that, someone's grabbing that, from a human standpoint, Abraham would be here and Lot would be here.
Right.
Because Abraham did not offer any of his kids up to someone else.
As prostitutes.
Correct, as a prostitute. Didn't do that. Abraham lied.
But then what else did Abraham do?
Well, there's lots of other stuff that Abraham did do. But I don't know, nowhere in Scripture does it say that Abraham went to that extreme. Go ahead.
And if he rescued righteous Lot, greatly distressed by the sensual conduct of the wicked, whereas that righteous man lived among them day after day, he was tormenting his righteous soul over their lawless deeds that he saw and heard.
When I uncovered that a number of years ago, that was one of the hardest things for me. It was one of the most eye-opening things for me. Because he was a guy that, by all accounts, we would say had slipped so far away from God and had done so many evil things that there is no way that God could call him righteous.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Peter is saying that Lot was living, the slow fade. He had faded away from what he knew was right, was
right.
Living in a world of sin, was responding from the very, his own actions were ones of grotesque sin. And yet God saw through that action and said, and called him a righteous man because he hated everything he was doing and was involved in.
He was the gatekeeper.
Can you wrap your brain around that?
That's hard. That is really hard. Because he rests, in your translation there, which translation are you reading?
ESV.
And it says he wrestled. Does it say use the word wrestled, or does it? It
no,
tormented.
It was tormenting
his soul, his heart. In other words, there was that battle going on within him that waged the whole time he lived there.
Now, it doesn't say he partook, but he said saw the curse.
He saw it, right. There's that torment going on within him because of what he was watching and seeing.
Now, he was a man, the gatekeeper, sitting at the gate.
I wonder if that's an insight to how our soul should be tormented today. I'm just thinking out loud here, so... Pardon me for thinking like this, but I
danger.
Can you imagine seeing the stuff that we see around us today, or reading about it, or hearing about it? It should torment our very soul.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it should literally tear us apart when we see the things that go against God and His character. That's a very powerful.
I think what I'm really hammering is, you know, we all know people who have said they're Jesus followers, who have said they're Christians, and over time their life has faded, has slipped, and they found themselves doing things that now we look at them and say, well, they sure did throw in the towel on their faith, but yet. Lot is a prime example of someone who kept fading away. He lived close to the city, turned his tent toward the city. He was living at the gates of the city, and then he was in the city to where he was calling the people of the city his friends.
Mm-hmm.
And he found himself in a situation, I interpret it that he found himself in a situation where he hated who he was, what he was doing, but he didn't know how to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And God saw right through that and saw his heart.
Mm-hmm.
And still called him a righteous man. I have difficulty grasping that. Heart of God. Because I can't do that. Because I can't separate
right.
The way I see people acting and what they do to me and others.
Right.
But that's because you can't see deep into their heart like you do.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean, I have heard it. You go to Romans 8 where Paul talks about what I want to do, I can't do. What I do,
hate doing.
I hate what I do, and what I don't want to do, I do, and this struggle deep within. And I'm talking way too much, but I hope you grasp what I'm saying.
Right.
Yeah.
That how can we look at people who are caught in doing things that they know are wrong, we know are wrong, and look at them through the eyes and saying, I see, what is your heart? What do you really want deep down in you?
Mm-hmm.
And I believe
that if you talk to many people who are caught in that, they will say, I don't like who I am. I just don't know how or have the strength. That's a reflection of sin. And when we allow sin to take such a stronghold, like your sermon, and place a castle in our lives, even though that's something that lives inside of us and has a control over parts of our life, we still can know who we are. We can still know that God is God. Mm-hmm. And that's something God looks beyond those strongholds, those castles, those things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what helps me understand that. Knowing that God's given me the love to see deep and not on what everything else is.
Yeah.
Sin is a drug.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Sin is a,
that's
yeah.
a drug.
Yeah.
Drug, there's a difference. Drugs are not, I'm not saying drugs
yeah.
are sin. Yes, drugs are sin, but sin is a drug.
Yeah.
It is, it is the same thing. It wraps, it draws, it pulls, it
walls.
Mm-hmm.
Walks us down the line deeper and deeper. It's the sin that Paul talks about, the sin that entangles, that grabs at us. And it's good stuff. A really good example, too.
But God doesn't end there. Now, as we saw what God said in the account of righteousness, but let's see what God does with Lot and his family. Genesis 19:10-17.
But the men inside reached out and pulled Lot back into the house and shut the door. Then they struck the men who were at the door of the house, young and old, with blindness so that they could not find the door. The two men said to Lot, "Do you have anyone else here, sons-in-law, sons or daughters, or anyone else in the city who belongs to you? Get them out of here, because we are going to destroy this place." The outcry to the Lord against its people was so great that it has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who were pledged to marry his daughters. He said, "Hurry and get out of this place, because the Lord is about to destroy the city." But his sons-in-law thought he was joking. With the coming of dawn, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Hurry, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away with the city when the city is punished." When he hesitated, the men grasped his hand and the hands of his wife and of his two daughters and led them safely out of the city, for the Lord was merciful to them. As soon as they had brought them out, one of them said, "Flee for your lives. Don't look back and do not stop anywhere in the plain. Flee to the mountains or you will be swept away."
God's merciful. Merciful. God is a merciful God.
That was a make haste, do it now.
It's almost like he's telling, well, he's saving Lot. But what I see in this, in that story there, in this part of history, is this cry out to Lot to once again make sure your path is straight. Stay with God. You know, here and I'm sparing your life. Move on. Get out. Get away. Get away from the things that entangle us. And he's saying that. We're going to skip down to 24 here, and to 24 and 25. But you have the verses in between there. They tell him to go to a certain place into the mountains, and Lot resists and says, "No, I would rather go over here, because if I go over here, then." You know, then my life shall be saved. You know, again, this whole thing. And then the angel said, "Okay, great, I'll grant your request. I will not destroy the little village that you wanted to escape to." God is merciful. And he is very, very gracious. 24 and 25.
Then out of the sky the Lord rained burning sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord. He demolished these cities, the entire plain, all the inhabitants of the cities, and whatever grew on the ground.
Fire and brimstone poured out from the heavens, just burned everything up. Even the ground, the vegetation around it. This is another example of God's hate on sin. God, his tremendous hate for sin, and how he, and this is just another example following up on Noah and kicking Adam and Eve out of the garden, and Cain cursing the ground that he lived. Just one after another, story after story so far, up to the first 19 chapters, we have God over and over again saying how much he hates disobedience, how much he hates sin. And God hasn't changed. That same hate for sin and disobedience is the same thousands of years ago as it is now. And the penalty hasn't changed either. It's still the same. In verse 17, they are commanded to not look back. It says, do not look back, right? Because if, and in verse 26, we have the sad part of this family who was spared. And it says, but Lot's wife looked back, and as she was following behind him, she turned into a pillar of salt. Just because Lot's heart was tormented and he wrestled and his heart still believed in the deliverer and he still was counted to him as righteousness, as we read in Peter, does not mean that Lot's wife's heart was right. She had to choose too. She had a choice. And her heart longed for the things that were in the city. And so she looked back. And God knew what was in her heart, just like he knew what was in Cain's heart, just like he knows our hearts. But why do you think she looked back? Was it the desire for what was in there, the sinful ways of Sodom? Or was it curiosity? No. God told him, don't look back. And she disobeyed. Again, showing the heart's desire of wanting to do my own will. Now, there's different definitions in the Hebrew language in the Old Testament for iniquity. But one of the definitions is doing what I want to do regardless of what God says. So when David says that in Psalms 51, against thee and thee, O Lord, have I sinned and done this evil in thy sight. Cleanse me from my iniquity. He's referring to cleanse me from doing what I want to do and not doing what you want me to do. I don't know about you, but there are many times in my life where there's warnings, God's warnings are there, and I've still resisted and done what I want to do, and you suffer the consequences from that. I do. And as she looked back, she turned into her salt, and that's kind of where Vince was, his theory was, well, that whole area is a Dead Sea. It's full of salt. You know, he says, is it possible that because of that whole vegetation, that whole area, that turned into the Dead Sea where we have nothing grows anymore? There's no way to prove that, but that's what he was saying last week when we were talking about her, his question, could that be possible?
Actually, I would tend to agree with that. And I think there is archaeological evidence that
in that region. Yeah, I didn't do any research on it, so
I'm just going from memory, but that's what I would have always understood.
So if that's the archaeological proof to that, we now have living evidence thousands of years later of a heart that refused to obey God. And the evidence of that still impacts our world today, because nothing grows in the Dead Sea.
Well, I'm not saying the pillar of salt. I'm saying the fire and brimstone.
Yeah, that's...
I mean, not just saying...
Yeah, not just the pillar of salt.
I've always wanted to know what that pillar of salt looked like. I mean, was it... She was like this, or was it just a pillar?
Right.
Or, you know,
like her.
Well, you have movies today that kind of give you that impression sometimes,
yeah,
where they shoot the gun
Mario
and you freeze. But... Yeah, so God was the first movie creator of something that we create today when it comes
Matt,
to that.
Matt, one thing I've written here in my notes is about Lot and versus his wife. And the question of, was Lot relieved to be taken out of Sodom? Not those winter dwellers.
I thought you were going to say one word. I thought you were going to do a joke or something.
Was Lot relieved be taken out of that city to have the help? See, where God sent two men. And if you put that in perspective with that mindset, that here was Lot leaving that city grateful, so glad I'm out of this, not even want to look back. But yet his wife's heart was not there. She had a long look back. Yeah. And I would actually take it even further. I have no evidence to back this up, but you could easily see how that it was his wife's influence that continually led them closer to the city.
Yeah, it could have been.
I don't know, but...
It could have been, or it could have been her husband putting her in that atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's all different ways of looking at it, but it is a pretty interesting thought process to the difference in the husband-wife relationship there and the struggle that must have been going on in their home. I don't know.
I just can't imagine what he would have went through. You're fleeing. Your wife you get to the city and you turn around, your wife's not there. Because I don't know if he would have known that she turned into a pillar of salt immediately as you're running, if she screamed, if she knew.
Right.
You don't know that. It's not written for it. But can you imagine he gets to the city where he's supposed to go and his wife's not there with him? That's the anguish that would have caused in his heart. We won't. I don't know if the next lesson talks about. No, we skip that. the next, you keep right on reading through there what happens with his daughters and how his daughters.
It's a very interesting lineup here because you have his daughters sleeping with their father, getting pregnant, having sons. Their sons became the Moabites and the Ammonites, who later, Abraham's descendants, had to fight and chase out of the land of Israel. The web this thing weaves is just amazing. It is an amazing story.
I
have a question for you.
Yeah.
When it said in my version, when men were taking Lot out of the city, and he hesitated, what was that hesitation? Was that you? It had, I guess, to get something looking back, but was it?
I view Lot as an extremely confused guy at this time. Just so torn, so wanting his son-in-laws to come along, they refusing, begging his wife and daughters to come with him. I imagine his wife and daughters giving him grief about this.
And so does that.
And
sometimes make us
hesitate to do what we know is right, because of the influence of our friends and our family. See, I see Lot as someone who, after hearing what Nathan read in Peter, I can also see Lot, especially him wanting his sons-in-laws to come with him, as one of these guys who I might go to a city to try to change the city to be the light. You can look at it like that too. That Lot tried to. This is a city that needs to have God in it.
But I kind of have a hard time envisioning Lot thinking that way. When
turn around
earlier
office.
When you were saying that he chose that because of the wealth and.
Yep.
Right.
You know,
the angels had to grab him by the hand and lead him out of there.
Yeah.
I have a hard time buying into that.
I'm just saying that's another way to look at it. I'm not saying that's what I believe.
The other thing I think is very interesting in this is that Lot's requests were being answered by the angels.
Mm-hmm.
They said to go to the mountains, and Lot said, I can't go that far. I don't know what, maybe he was a chunky monkey, I don't know.
He was older, I'm sure.
Yeah, up in years. But then he said, okay, go to this town. It's very small.